you come to me because the reason or because I do care or because I do both? We run a design house which manufactures and retails. So we are...
Could you take a step back and say, like, you personally, how did you get into the work you're doing and how did it develop? I mean, where did you
started it together with my brother 25 and a half years ago. I guess we started working maybe 26 and a half years ago. But anyway, so the concept...
Were you students before that or were you already...
No.
I mean, it was 26.
Normal life.
I think you must be 5 years old when you started.
Yes, absolutely. Five and a half. Normally I just graduated. No concept. I don't come from a serious business family. I do not know other women in business in my family even today. So it was the concept was my father had just a few years before this time I had graduated. I was married. My brother went abroad and did an MBA, which was a thing to do. Came back and what do we do? My father at that time had started. He had been worked for a multinational all his life, and when that multinational collapsed, it was a shipping company or whatever. And then he was like, "What should I do now?" So another multinational, and then gradually he got these two embroidery machines, which do regular embroidery, Swiss Zangs, German. Those were the first ones with German Zangs. And they were doing regular embroidery for the market. And there's this huge...
Your father started.
Yes. But then that was what he was doing. The embroidery industry collapsed. And my brother and I... I think various things there. It was a very low quality basic embroidery which would get exported to, I think, the Middle East, to wherever. Worldwide, apparently, it was the embroidery industry was crashing out. It was a very Swiss, European. We started 85, but this was about 82, 83. The embroidery industry just collapsed. It wasn't a huge industry. It was very basic. It had crashed out. And my brother and I just thought, all these machines were Swiss or German. And we were young enough and stupid enough to think, we have the same machines as the Swiss. Look at what they do. Look at what we do. So we will create a product equal to the best in the world, and it will be made in Pakistan. This was the entire dream, the entire concept behind equal to the best in the world made in Pakistan. And everyone we met, we knew, including my father actually, he doesn't like to own up to it anymore, they said, "You're totally mad, you guys have lost it. How do you make quality in Pakistan?" It might seem okay to you now, but at that time there was no product which was quality, which was Pakistani. All the fabric was cheap, imported, smuggled, whatever. So, and then I remember people saying, "And if you ever manage to make it, where are you going to sell it? How are you going to sell it?" Because there was no concept of, making Pakistani. Anyway, so we struggled away with designs and concepts and ideas and managed in about 8-9 months to actually create a product. And we had no money. The two of us started it together, my brother and I. It was our own capital, our own whatever. And we had precious little... Our own, yes, I will. In a while you can see some of it, I guess. I'm wearing it also. That's it. This is it.
How much capital?
Very tiny, minute amounts, absolutely minute. But anyway, so what we could afford was, we said, now how do we sell it? So we surveyed the market, and it was impossible. Market had these huge mafias where you would give them your product and they'd never paid on time, and then, for years afterwards you were trying to collect, recover money, whatever. And the market didn't want new things. No one understood. Pakistani, who's going to? No, cheap. And anyway, when you make quality, it's never cheap. So anyway, we thought we'd have an outlet of our own. And we bought a shop in the basement of Shadman Market. It was a foreign goods market, all a smuggled goods market. We thought, you know, where should we have a shop? And we said, okay, this is where all the women go to buy fabric, but it was smuggled or imported fabric. And anyway, there was this new plaza, so we could afford a shop in the basement. And we bought this basement little shop. And we built it up like, you know, we thought it should be, so which was obviously looked different to all the stores. We made this product line, which was very exciting.
Nice,
exactly
nice
what we wanted. No, very small, very basic.
Was it very nicely done?
Very nicely done in that it was all very nicely, elegantly.
Okay.
We've never, even if you look at our shops today, none of them is overdone. Nothing is, it's all straight lines, nice, but it was all wood.
Functional,
but nicely done. No. Anyway, and so I remember when we were trying to sort of set up shop or whatever, or even otherwise, normally it's Pathans, it's the people from the northwest, Khyber Pakhtunkhwa, who sell all the fabric in that market. And a lot of them came and said, oh, you're going to sell this, Pakistani fabric, you're never going to manage. We have 2-3 solid offers, sell us the whole lot, we'll stamp it with made in France, made in England, and we'll sell it. And we said, oh my God, we'll put the whole thing in the middle of the square, we'll burn it, and we'll stamp every yard with made in Pakistan. And we actually did. We said, we're going to sell it as made in Pakistan, otherwise we'll burn it. And we stamped every yard with made in Pakistan. Lucky or unlucky or whatever, we couldn't, you know, one stamping system we tried, the ink ran, something else we tried didn't work, and so we opened shop with, you know, some products marked, stamped made in Pakistan, others didn't. Anyway, and but everybody thought that it's never going to work. And we opened this little store, and just by word of mouth, we passed the word around, friends and family already knew. And just from day one, it was this huge, whopping success. And everybody would walk in, would say, you know, we got a reputation that there's a shop which sells imported fabric and calls it Pakistani. Because everyone would walk in and say, this is Pakistani, such good quality. No, it's not possible. And then when we'd convince them, for the first few weeks or so, we manned shop ourselves, did whatever. Had a couple of salespeople, but manned shop. And I still remember, people would walk in and say, no, this can't be made in Pakistan. It's amazing quality. And by the time I'd convinced them, no, it's made in Pakistan, look, we design it, we make it ourselves, and then it's too expensive. If it's foreign, they're willing to pay. But anyway, it was very soon, within weeks, months, we couldn't produce enough. People would be waiting outside to buy the product. It's all fabric. We were a pure cotton enterprise. We only did pure cottons in all forms, fine, thick, whatever. And then we just quickly built, got another shop, and then we did an exhibition in Karachi, and oh my God, it was a riot. We had a 3-day exhibition. We ran out of everything on the first day, and you know, people.
What year was that?
This was 86,
yeah.
85, end of 85. We opened our store in Lahore, April 1985, 6th April 85, and by the end of 85, we already were this whopping success. And
how many people are working for you?
Oh my God, we had those 3 machines which we were managing. We are like external customers for my father's factory. We've always been, it was our own business, and we were like any client.
Did you provide the designs for them to make it?
No, everything. The only advantage was we could control quality of the factory. That was the biggest advantage. But some of the funniest things were the dyeing. You know, nobody could understand. We wanted just fast colors, and we wanted colors which wouldn't bleed and wouldn't change and da-da-da-da. And no, we ended up paying more per yard of dyeing than people were paying per yard for dyed fabric. We were just very quality conscious. We checked 100% everything, and the quality had to be anyway. So we just went on from there, and another store and another. Today we actually have over 100 in Pakistan. And then as we went on, we thought we should go abroad. It was about brands. We just created a brand. It got very well known, very famous, and then we thought, yes. We said we have to take a Pakistani brand abroad. The concept was always that. And so we went to the Middle East. We were the first Pakistani brand. Dubai. They have 6 stores there.
In Dubai.
Dubai, Sharjah, Abu Dhabi, and we now have 3 in England, 1 in Malaysia, We're open.
Where is it in England?
There's one in London, in Leicester, in Manchester, and yes, that's it. That's the three. Then in Delhi, from a long time. So one of the biggest excitements was that when visitors came from India or where, that was, you know, if you questioned them, that was amongst the top five things they all wanted to buy. And early on, I used to get these requests that everyone who comes from India wants to buy very easy. It's a fabric. Then we went on to add other brands. We were the first chain store in Pakistan. There is no concept of chain. When we started, the owners just manned the stores. We did chain.
Right. Okay.
Yeah. I thought.
Yeah, we're good. Thank you.
No.
Thank you. Yeah, thank you very much. I've been wearing the razor since a little girl. I can attest to it, yeah. And my mom only buys the razor.
No, why not?
Only buys the razor.
You have good taste.
I let you know that.
Yeah, absolutely. So we just started our... The first day we opened the first store in Dubai, maybe it was 16, 17 years ago. And wow, the response is...
So how many people do you employ now?
Now about 5,000.
About 5,000. Is anything that you've said to us written up or available?
Yes, yeah. Okay. I guess
any of this, anything that you have in terms of newspaper articles or... we should introduce ourselves, but we have in our group one person who is a writer who is going to be writing some profiles of different entrepreneurs that we need. So.
Namkeen Bilana, I should give you a profile.
And let us give you a full disclosure that we didn't do. We really wanted to hear your story firsthand, so we really did do a profile of research on you before. Okay. You are globally famous.
Oh,
I noticed that I'm here, but really wanted to hear your story before we did our research. But obviously, I'm sure there's a lot of stuff out there. So anything you can share with us is wonderful.
Loving it. It's been such an exciting journey, is all I can tell you. I've enjoyed every minute of what I've done. And yes, we stayed with it. We were the first chain. When we started, there was no concept of chain. And many years later also, people would come here and meet me and say, how do you run your stores in Peshawar? How do you run them in Karachi? You're sitting here, and I say, oh my God.
But it's international chains as well?
We just do our own brands.
Right.
But
I'm saying, as far as the change in the business environment, your change, were they the first... Local brands?
Yes.
Chains, or were there other chains?
There were no local
chains.
No concept of chain.
No concept of chain.
The owners sat in the store.
Right.
There was no concept of brand. We were absolutely the first brand for years and years. No Pakistani brands. No concept of brand.
I've heard this same story. Nadeem Mohawk, who we were talking about earlier, was telling the story of a family that had a department store. It may have been here in Lahore.
Which department? H. Kareem Baksh.
It could be, right? And they were very successful, and they had three floors. And
that's
they asked
it.
Why don't you create another one? And it's because we have three brothers, and they can man the three tills, and they can't have any more brothers.
Just machine buckets.
So how did you get that?
When we walked into the business, and we were total novices because we're not really a business family, and I think it was the innovation of being total newcomers.
Right.
I mean, we did what we wanted.
Like, so who manned the store? So that's so you broke your gum.
No, we hired people.
You hired
people. Yes, yes.
And they didn't take your money?
No.
Oh, exactly.
I keep telling everyone. You trust people. They will rise to it.
Absolutely.
People are fabulous. You have to trust them.
Even schools.
Even the schools.
Beacon House did start branching out or franchising until the 90s, or did this start in the 80s?
I know.
But you're right. There were no.
There was no concept. There was no concept.
So your first store was your second store was a franchise?
Not the second, the third. In Karachi was a franchise. So at that time, those were relatives. They were very scared. So, but they wanted to franchise. So we were partners in that franchise.
Okay.
See, that was the first franchise, and we were partners in that. Now, at this moment, I think 40% of our stores are franchised.
Franchise people.
Everyone who walks in and wants to franchise. we have proper documentation for franchising, you know, whatever proper documents. And
in Islamabad, you have some shops.
Right? Those are all our own.
Do you, for your franchisees, do you have a, what kind of training do you, provide them with documentation? But
that's the tough one. I run most of the franchise. Yeah, we end up running most of the franchises. We do have a training. I mean, we try to train them. We've got systems, procedures, everything's documented. Our rules are documented. But people don't always want to go by those rules. We have rules of how to treat the salespeople, of how much they must be paid and all that. And people sort of bypass some of them, and then it doesn't work so well. So we've ended up managing a lot of franchises ourselves. I find it so much easier. It's so much easier. They've invested, that's it. But I request them not to enter the store, because when they do something good, they manage to mess it up.
Or if they, the franchise is a capital
investor. Well, so it's about attitudes, right? You know, and I find it much easier. I just run 90%, 95% of the stores. I just run. Well, they can hire the people, but we train them, and then we manage them. Even if our, you know, whatever, it's their people, they pay them, but we will manage them, the entire thing.
To win a franchise, to provide management service.
Yes, absolutely. And that's free, you know. That's a thought. We should charge for the management service.
Well, just to get your reaction, because I don't know.
Right.
If a young student at Lums was to come to you and say, we're going to help you train your franchisees, what would you respond to that?
They won't do it. That's the tough part. Even today, it's not the acceptable or the job of choice to be store manager or anything. And I don't think such trainings, we get trainings. Now, you know, we tell the training company, there are training companies, whatever, and we'll tell them exactly what we want. And it's a growing thing, but it's not at the level of Lums. I don't think they're even thinking yet of training store managers.
Right, I know. Well, that's partly what I'm trying to get at, is like, first of all, that student wouldn't exist.
The student wouldn't exist.
If some student said they wanted to do that, do you think that they would even be able to think at the level that you work? I mean, is the disconnect too great?
Yes, but it doesn't matter what any problem is. But it's, yes, you're absolutely. No, it's all, everyone's educated. So right. I mean, there's some high. So. Yeah. But it's not about degrees. I actually have this issue with universities and colleges.
And that's why I'm asking the question.
Wherever I have the opportunity, and I don't think people like me a lot, but I really believe that something is wrong with education in that it does not connect people to the real world. Mm-hmm. Everyone who walks into this office now, I'm now getting tired and saying I'm not going to train anymore, but we just train. All the designers, there never used to be designers, by the way, there's no concept of embroidery designers, and it's been a long story of train people. There are no concepts. Now you get, but our MBAs, I don't know, maybe that happens around the world. They do not make people ready for real life. They just don't. And if people are clever and they actually do work experience 3 years after graduation, they do much better when they go on to university. And I say this all the time to anybody who comes to interview with me or something. I want to know how many years they've worked before they go in for a master's degree. But you know, people like to skip that. People like to do a bachelor's, do something, you know, mess around for a year or so, and then do a master's. It's a bad plan, really bad plan.
I didn't want to divert us too much, but I think just when you were talking about training and capability, you know, so it's something that, you know, has to be done through practice, and you end up taking most of them over because it's hard to do.
That's right.
Yeah.
Also, maybe a newer generation. See, okay, over the last 8-9 years, a lot of chains have come up. For the first 16 years or so, we basically had a free run, you know. There was neither competition nor any other chains or anything else. And we went on to create many new brands, you know. After a few years, we said, okay, now what else is going to be connected to this? So we started a ready-to-wear line for young girls and boys, age 6 to age 5 to like 18. And then it's, of course, gone on to all ages. And then we created a children's brand of newborn to age 5.
Mm-hmm. That does...
It's called Mini Miners. It does phenomenally well. And it's great fun. Because before we created these brands, again, all ready-to-wear for children was imported, or bad quality. And it was so much fun when people started saying, you know, first we used to buy from abroad and bring it home for people. Now we buy from here and we take it to for friends abroad. It was so much fun.
Not the Barise brand?
No, we own them all. It is Barise brands because, the company is CFAM and Barise is the main brand.
Right.
And then there's Leisure Club. Uh-huh. There's Mini Miners.
Mini Miners. Okay, okay.
And the funnest part is that every last toy in Mini Miners we make locally. When we, as Mini Miners kept progressing and we wanted to add toys and, you know, every new thing, and every so often the brand manager or the team would come and say, you know, we should import these from China. We can make toys in Pakistan, that's why not? And we proceeded to make everything. I said, we're going to try. There's Leisure Club, there's Mini Miners, there's Chanel, which is ready to wear for women, and it goes on to couture and bridal. There's Home Expressions, which does its home furnishings. And we have a Mom to Be. We were the first people to create a maternity brand. It's called Mom to Be. Sorry? We have Chanel. Chanel has a whole men's line. A whole men's line. And then there's Mom to Be. And now we have a print brand, which is Kesaria. But the fun has been always, for me, has been that, you know, we create the expertise. Even in Mini Miners, you might have, if you ever go, there's lots of smocked frocks and things. So there was nobody who could do smocking here. We trained master trainers, then we trained a whole workforce, then we now do thousands of smocked frocks every year, and then we trained the toy people, and we make thousands of toys.
I'm sorry, just two quick questions. We have a whole group of people, first of all, just because it's relevant to what we're doing, at no point in your naturally conveyed narrative do you bring up anything having to do with tariffs, with permitting, with any sort of government, anything. So was the role obstacles in terms of supplies and dyes? I mean, was there any way in which government action has been either an impediment to your work? Or I can't imagine how it would have been helped, but anyway.
You know, I'm just thinking quickly as you're speaking. Government is not a support in any way. So you really...
Is it an hindrance?
It would be. I've heard people... See, I guess...
For you, have you experienced?
No, what I'm going to say is we had this other attitude. I don't look at anything as a hindrance. It's just something to make you think and overcome.
Okay.
Every obstacle is something you just have to go by.
Sure.
You have a target.
Sure.
This is what we want to do.
Sure.
So if you look at it as a hindrance, then everything is a hindrance.
Uh-huh.
Electricity is a problem. To get a connection is a problem. To get a phone line is a problem.
Right.
But it's really not. You keep finding ways around it. And you keep going forward. The good thing about government is that they don't bother you, because everything was in the country. I mean, we weren't importing. But they do bother you in that one huge problem was we were very particular, and we, in the first year, every last, even if I bought a yard of fabric out of my own store, it was written down. We had cash memos. We kept stringent records, and everything was absolutely above board. And so we filed our tax returns. And good, so far so good. Next year, our sales had doubled. And we filed those, and they called us up. They said, why have your sales doubled? They should have tripled. And they took us into... They filed this thing against us, and we fought it out. It was, I mean, it would have been much easier to pay somebody, but we fought it out. We went into tribunal, into everywhere, and won in the end. My God, but every, no, it's not mess around, but everyone told us what fools you are. Who told you to be 100% honest? If you pay all your taxes, this is what happens to you. And they brought up silly things like, you know, there are no names on the cash memos of who you sold to. Look, in this country, some of the largest stores don't have cash memos still. We started correct from day one. We're all totally computerized now. And, you know, whatever was the new technology, we really suffered. So those are problems. Government's own, I'm so sorry, government's own systems are not good. They do not respect people who do. I mean, they don't respect you for any good that you do. They have their own silly ways, like when they crack down and put the sales tax on. We pay more tax, which we brought up to them, than the entire Liberty Market, you know, where one of our shops was. They made this silly formula of whatever anyone's paying, they're going to double it, and that's fine. Some people were paying like 2% or 1% of what they should be paying.
Charmingly bureaucratic.
So then we were the only people, we went all the way. Again, we'll be known to be fighters. We just fought it out at every stage. We went to see the generals, we went to see everyone. We said, how do you expect us to double? I mean, we're not paying 100%, but we're already on 70%, 80%. We can't do that. And look at us, one shop is paying more than your entire market, or, you know. So those are the sort of things which government is sort of blind. They don't differentiate and they don't correct their own, you know, systems. Bureaucracy is a bit of a problem. It needs an overhaul. And but the thing to do is, I can only say that, I mean, I'm bringing all these things back to mind because you're asking the questions. Otherwise, we've forgotten to worry about problems. If you want to really be successful here, you don't look at the obstacles. You have to just keep going in spite of them. Otherwise, you can sit and cry forever, and nothing's going to change.
I want to ask you something.
Yeah.
In your progress,
yes.
And all this,
yes.
You become enormously big, $5,000.
Yes.
And you start small, you become big.
Yes.
Now, did you, on the matter of funding, did you depend completely on your own resources, or did you go to a bank, or did you raise any capital? Did you get any partners?
No. Partner. She just, you know, because we were putting in this little capital and both of us had no money, and so she said, I'll put in equal, you know, so we're three equal partners, so that's it. But we were very, very conservative. First, we believed in buying every little store that we had, and that went crazy because, yeah, anyway. And then we didn't want any loans. So, no, today we do have loans, which is a bad plan. So, over the years, we would only borrow if we needed to tide us over.
Okay, and
yes, just working capital.
Why is it that?
I don't know.
Is it that you're uncomfortable, or because from a business standpoint?
Makes me very uncomfortable.
These are debt loans.
And no, loans is, you take running capital?
Right, no, equity, or is it debt or equity?
Yes. What do you mean, debt?
No,
debt. Not equity. We never used it for equity.
No, but there's no other partners. It's still
there. No, there's just the three of us. Okay. That's it. The partner, there is no more, nobody else in the equity.
Right.
But yes, we had debt loans.
Okay.
Like, you know, whenever we are short of running capital, we would have this limited amount, which we thought we'd take for the first few years, very, very little. And even till recently, very little. Then we put up a dyeing finishing unit, which for which also we partly generated the capital, from the one company had made money. The one company had made money. We just kept reinvesting
right.
Whatever we were making. That was our main, you know.
Internal generation of funds.
Internal. But then we did take loans, but we were very good about paying them off as fast as we could and not allowing it to accumulate.
Yes. Yeah.
That's.
So the other thing is, you mentioned 100 schools. So,
200 schools.
Wait, I want to stick on this loan, why the loan is a bad idea. And if you're so eager to pay them off so quickly, why would you then not look at equity investors?
You know, we were very conservative. Basically, we're conservative. I think the whole society is conservative. Equity and investment and sharing in your business is still a newer concept. Maybe because we're not so structured either. You know, structures are maybe not so good, but I can only tell you, I've never thought about that. But also, how do you, there's no good processes of evaluating business. If you bring in a partner, how will you bring that partner in? What will be the value on things?
Exactly.
We called in a company a year or so ago, 2 years ago, evaluate, to put a price on every share, and gosh, they worked for 6-8 months and couldn't come up with anything correct. And apparently, I think that's the problem, because...
You brought somebody to value?
Well, actually, it was a local, very good audit and whatever company. And no, it wasn't working out at all. After many months, they couldn't, you know, there's a process, and they couldn't do it right. And that's the biggest problem, I think, because you will not find any buying and selling of businesses in Pakistan. It doesn't happen because it's difficult to put value on things, and all that is difficult. Our procedures are not yet that fine-tuned.
But then this is absolutely fascinating, and it's also really inspiring for me to hear. Especially, I also love. I don't want to digress now, but you, as a woman doing business in Pakistan, I can only imagine how challenging that is, because it is a really very, very patriarchal society.
Is it or not?
I don't know. That's why a lot of people, you know, whoever would. I'm saying I'm a bad sample, because I don't really concentrate on the problems, so I'm just a bad example.
And see, I've
sort of enjoyed it all a lot.
But see, that's what I love hearing, and that, I think, is a message that really should get out, and to not only women in Pakistan, but I think it should get out to women all over the world. I think that is a real, very powerful message, and thank you for sharing that. But it's also, it doesn't reconcile with how you also scaled up this business.
Yes.
And so you're saying, on the one hand, there's a problem with this valuation and it's never been done, but on the other hand, you also said that you were the first chain store in Pakistan.
Absolutely.
And you were the first to open up overseas.
Yes.
So I would love for you just to maybe talk a little bit more about that, because those two things don't actually reconcile. Well, because she's conservative in terms of...
Internal generational.
Yeah, we're
in terms of financing equity,
you're taking a huge risk in doing
We're not scared. I think we're real entrepreneurs, not scared of taking the risk.
Right.
Risk, as long as it's in your control. I don't know, I personally have this real worry of getting into a debt that I can't repay, on things crashing in. But otherwise, to take a chance with the money that we have no issues with that. We keep, everything we ever did was a risk. Every last thing was a risk. It had never been done before. Never.
Just one little detail. So your father's looms.
Yes.
Did you use them? Was that part of the...
Yes, those are the embroidery machines. Those are what we used.
So the fact that your father had that available,
he had the
one
two.
Little bit of...
Yes,
so
absolutely.
You needed the capital to...
We were like external business there.
Right, exactly.
Like he used to make for the market on payment. I mean, the market would pay for every yard that was made. We do exactly the same thing.
His father has his own business, but they really
got... Yes. But it was a great benefit that we had it, because we could. That's how we could tweak those machines to get quality. The quality that we wanted out of those machines was a huge issue. I mean, it's lucky that we had the authority to manage that factory. Otherwise, the quality might have been much more difficult.
Right, because if you were contracted to buy the machine,
you had the attitude to experiment with the machines
to get to the quality you wanted.
Absolutely. And so today he started from I think he has 30 machines now. We have the state of the art. So we also, as Barize, started buying our own machines. We bought 5, and those were the first time state of the art computerized Saura machines came in. But then, my father said that, I'll can keep buying the machines, you guys can keep doing what you're doing. And so we didn't then, we have five machines which are all our own, the rest are his.
I just wanted to connect that if that shipping company hadn't gone under,
yes, he would have.
5,000 people wouldn't have been delighted working for you in Pakistan.
That's how chance works out.
Yeah. Can I ask you a question about, like, it's amazing that you're actually creating your own brands at different target audiences.
Yes.
What about brand copies of your brand?
You know, right in the beginning, for the first 7 years, nobody knew what was happening.
Okay.
But 7-8 years later, suddenly there were these copies. And you know, I'd created everything. The color schemes I'd done, the designs were totally different, totally new, never had been made before. And I was just doing exactly what I wanted to. And then suddenly, you know, there were these copies in the market. And I remember people saying to me, all of Itra is full of Marise and you have to come and see. And I remember the first time I walked down Itra, because you realize I got really busy. I was doing care as well as this, and I never had time to walk out. Anyway, so I walked up that hole. This is a bazaar, and it has little shops.
Yeah.
And on both sides, in every shop, were copies of my designs, my colors. And I remember I was so unhappy that first day, and I said, oh my God, you know, everyone's copied my exact designs and my exact colors. But then I started stopping at the shops to look, and it was such bad quality, I can't tell you. And I came away saying, oh my God, if they had to copy, why can't they do it properly?
So you went to train.
But you know, it's like your baby, you've created something and the whole world's got it copied. But then we just stayed ahead. After that I realized also, you know, I was very unhappy for the first couple of weeks or months, and I said, this is annoying, you know, because there's no patenting, and how can you, and people have no worries with copying, they just come and buy a yard out of our shop and just copy anyway. But then I got used to the idea, and I said, I understand that markets grow and other people have to do all this, but why can't people do individual thinking? That was my problem. Why can't anyone else innovate? So for years there was no other innovation.
Did it have any impact on your sales? Appreciable?
I don't know. If there was somebody who'd done a market survey, if there were systems in the country which were doing surveys and tell us what percentage of market share we had and were we losing it or was it growing, I honestly don't know.
But it wasn't dramatic.
No, we kept doing better and better all the time. And and sales kept doubling and tripling, and that's how we've come to so many stores nationwide and have kept growing. And now the stores are fairly large, and they still do very well.
Can you talk a little bit about that I think that's so important, because on the one hand, you have the copiers and competitors, and you're scaling up, and you're innovating.
Yes.
And I think the struggle that an entrepreneur has, it's not starting a business, it's actually scaling it up.
Yeah.
And I'm an entrepreneur and I wanted to start a business, maybe not in Pakistan, but you know, somewhere else. What advice would you give me in order to, how do you straddle that?
You know, I can only tell you what we did, and I tell you our basic concepts were to do the right thing, never to take the customer for a ride, to deliver quality, because I believe quality never goes out of fashion, but maybe the most important thing we did was innovate. You have to, especially if it depends on what industry, if it's the fashion world, then it's a very fast moving, evolving world at this time. You cannot stagnate. And what I did was that even till today, I oversee and do every last design myself. One thing I believe in, that you can never sit back on your laurels and say, we're very good now. So we never did that. We continued the process of improvement all the time. Our quality was always correct. And
but those are two different things. Making sure that your quality is high caliber,
yes,
and innovating I mean,
and so what else?
How do you do those two things at the same time, especially in a place like Pakistan?
Well, that's the struggle, I guess. But you just have to focus on it, and you do it. Like she's telling you, we did a survey about 7-8 years ago, and I didn't really want to do it. Other people in the company did. And anyway, survey, and what was the results of the survey? They surveyed, I don't know how many hundred people, and the main things which came out, they said, is what a problem it is. Barize fabric doesn't fade, it doesn't spoil, our cupboards are now piled up, we don't want to give them away to our maids, is what they said, because it's beautiful. And some of our designs were, you know, selling for like 14 years, same design, same everything. And they said, we can't even give them away because our friends will come in wearing it brand new. And the biggest problem is it doesn't fade, it doesn't tear, it doesn't... So that was actually what is... So quality, but I guess why should it be an anomaly for you? You can do quality and you can innovate and do new things. And what we did was I innovated a whole lot. Created new fabrics, new concepts of fabrics, and that's what kept us going. Like I remembered from my grandmother's time, net. You know, net, and I love embroidery myself. And I couldn't find the net anymore. And then on fairs abroad, I found Swiss net and French net, and I ordered that, but it didn't work, whatever. And then I actually developed net here, actually developed it. And it worked really well for 2 years or so, or three, and then the market started copying it. When the market copies, they want to drop price. They got quality. And then everything got destroyed. Our net, which was selling like crazy, suddenly you could get it at half price in bad quality, and then people stopped buying it. But you know, all these...
In that case, you did see that the imitation cost you.
It does cost, but then what happens is that I've now learned. One, I know when I create something brand new, I know, do I have a year on it or do I have two? Depends on what it is. On some things, there are huge barriers to entry and people don't understand what we've done and don't know what I've done. So it might take them a year, it might take them two. So I already, when I do something new, I'm saying, okay, how many years do I have in here? And then, because I want to, I'm always thinking of something new, and we've gone on to something new. By the time they've caught up, we've gone on to something new. We've walked out, and because you know it becomes a dead ball. You don't want to keep doing the same thing, and our customers don't want the same thing, and I don't want the same thing anyway. So we just move on.
Can I ask you a question about the net? So after 2 years, when people were copying the net, did you decide to then go out of the net business and go to another?
Sadly, I'd ordered a. I loved the net. No, then we stopped making the net. And then I changed the concept and we actually sold a lot of net, but I did something totally different on it. I did something
totally
different.
But when the market stops copying you, you change your strategy.
Yes.
So.
You just have to, because what happens is they destroy, you know, when somebody starts selling what you're selling at half price on half the quality, then the people who want to buy the expensive don't want to buy it because the whole world's wearing it and it's bad quality and, you know, doesn't... Yes, so we just change strategy. We move on.
You also said that some of your designs have been selling for 14 years.
Yeah.
So, I mean, is it...
Those are classics.
The classics.
Yeah.
But do you feel like you have this customer loyalty where people... I mean, we talked about this the other day. I mean, in New York, you know, there's these Chanel bags that are copies that sell for $20.
Yeah.
And in the corner, there are people who are going on their credit cards and paying $2,000 for that same bag.
Absolutely.
But it's you know, so do you see that in your customers?
Yes.
That there are people who even, you know, that they will buy...
There's tons of loyalty. That's what keeps us going.
Right.
You know, for the longest time, if we sell... a yard for ₹1,000, people would make copies and open little pavement shops opposite us, our store, and they'll sell a whole suit for ₹1,000. And but our customers, it's never hurt our sales. We don't stamp, there's no stamp on our fabric. And we learned that in the early years. And we only sell it through stores which have our name, because we wanted the customer to... you know, to be able to feel the quality and know a fake from a real. And it's worked forever. But it's the quality. There's no stamp. And so people have learned to stay, you know, to be more cautious and also be more aware.
To learn
yes.
Themselves.
the numbers has to differentiate. Because they do. And it's amazing.
Yeah.
People sell, you know, what we do, and sometimes I think now that the whole world has the same machines that we do. That now this country is full of the same sourdough machines, the same system, the same fabric, and yet, you know, they can't manage to make the same quality that
we
make.
That's interesting.
I innovate
that because culturally, I mean, my parents are Turkish.
Yes.
And the one thing that I notice is that Turks are very tactile. They touch
yes.
one another.
Yeah, right.
And in the West, they don't. I mean, particularly in Europe,
yes.
if not, there's
yes.
there's definitely personal
yes.
space and you don't
yes.
touch one another. Now, in Europe, there are labels. And
yes.
that's how you can tell if something's Prada, if something is
absolutely
Hugo
right.
Boss.
Yes.
And that's interesting because I know my mother does the same thing. She'll touch something
yes.
and she'll say, she'll know what the quality
yes.
is. And did you do that because of the Pakistani?
No.
Pakistanis are the same way.
No. We did it because of the possibility of buying fakes here and copies.
Right.
There are no rules, no laws to stop people copying you and selling fakes. We only did it. No, Pakistanis also don't touch a lot. I think we also... Stamps can be copied. See, like I told you... Yes, you feel the material. No, you don't feel people ever. No, you don't touch people.
Really?
No. Yeah, you don't touch people. But you'll feel the fabric, and I think that comes from that fact that you don't always know what you're buying.
I mean, I'm shocked as, you know, to your point, like, I was shocked growing up that every time we go to the store,
yes.
my mom instantly knew which was the closet.
Yeah.
Any brand or anything.
My grandfather was
yes.
in that same business in Tunisia.
And you're carrying on that tradition without branding. I mean,
yes.
kind of.
We have to not do it. We brand it, every store is branded. We do not allow Barize to sell. We never give it to random people. Only a franchise. And franchise means the store looks exactly like ours.
Right.
It's sold the same way. So that it's not sold elsewhere. But this whole feeling thing is to prevent people from, it's to differentiate between fakes and the real thing.
Can I ask you a follow-up question?
Yes.
How much time do you have?
It's okay.
One of the things I wanted to ask you is that you went from a startup to 5,000 people. Now, part of this data we're also doing is really scaling up.
Yes.
So a lot of times, you know, retail brands, the way they scale up is they then open up, you know, they will sell to, like, different things.
No.
Like, it's not, like, Gen 1. Is that just...
No.
No.
It's not about making money only. For me, it's not about making money at all. I mean, it is. Of course, the money is a byproduct. But it's the business which is important. It's what you do is important. What you create is important. For me, the product and the processes were very, very important. Like I told you, it's all about... I really thought when people started coming to me and saying very seriously in the brands that we have to now import, it's half the price, you'll make double the money. And I said, it's not of interest to me. It's not of interest. Our country is at a time and a stage where our labor needs jobs. And if you import, one, you have nothing in your control. What about your workers? Our people need the jobs. And I can't understand why we can't do what another country is doing. And so I've stayed with it. For me, I was doing this course in Harvard Business School for the last 3 years. And I remember in the first year, whatever group discussions were, and I said exactly this. I said, business is not about making money. So there is such a... Everyone said, okay, we want you to say this in the middle of the class. You're sitting in Harvard Business School, you're saying, business is not about making money. But I found that there were other people who were saying the same thing. But honestly, to me, business is not about money. That's not the focus. The focus is, what are you doing to me? I mean, the joy is the creation, not the money.
I have to say I'm a little concerned, because I mentioned that Elmer would, you know, be writing a profile or something.
Yes.
But she may be now writing a book, and you may see a lot. I'm exaggerating, but I'm just saying that your story is very compelling, and the way you tell it is very compelling.
You know, I was just thinking, you were asking, and why we are so different. I haven't thought of it for a while, but I think I'm the only one in the industry. I keep saying,
very, very interested in innovation. And I thought, maybe because I'm the consumer as well as the creator and the manufacturer, maybe I have a better grip on it. The rest of the industry is all men. It's a totally male dominated. There's no woman in the embroidery industry. And I would like to believe that that's the difference. I really like that. But anyway, maybe the guys won't agree with me. That's what I'd like to believe, but it's that's why we do better.